Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Really excited because with us today, we have Ash Avedia. Ash is the Managing Director of Multiplier Capital. Ash, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks, Christian. It's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Oh, my pleasure. So why don't we start with Multiplier Capital? Would love to know what you guys are focused on. And how you're providing the market liquidity.
Sounds great. So Multiplier Capital has been around since 2012. We've managed about $1.1 billion under management. We've had success raising four funds. So currently our funds 3 and 4 are active that we're investing out of. We are looking for companies that are selling mission-critical products and services to the market. Broadly speaking, we invest in technology and technology-enabled services business, okay? The number one sell mission-critical stuff. How I define that to be is stuff that's really hard to rip and replace and causes actual pain to the customer if they have to replace the technology. These companies have to be professionally backed. So what I mean is a VC or some kind of an investor should be around the hoops. They should have strong recurring or reoccurring business models. So, that is one of the key metrics that we've found, or I've found, or my partners have found, that it makes for a good debt investment. And frankly, these companies have to be addressing large end markets and they have to have growth. So all of those factors kind of help us hone in on companies we invest in. And broadly speaking, as I said at the top of my response, that we look for companies that are technology and technology-enabled services businesses. So we're sort of across industries in tech. So lately we've been seeing a lot of deal flow in enterprise software, cloud infrastructure, cybersecurity, digital media, healthcare IT and tech, defense tech. And of course, AI-related companies.
Great. And so, you know, I'd love to get your perspective of how you go about identifying potential business or businesses to potentially lend to.
I mean, look, I think most of our business, as is no surprise to you, venture debt. You know, I got into venture debt about 16 plus years ago. One thing that hasn't changed is this is a relationship business, right? So a lot of the deal flow that comes through is coming from the ecosystem, whether it's, venture investors, operators that I've invested with or worked with in the past, lawyers and bankers that are around the hoop. Number one, it's the inbounds that come through. A lot of it is just sort of self vetting, if you will, right? Once the sort of company's sort of in the top of funnel, we really hone in on the qualities that I mentioned before, right? Like, do we first see the fact that this business has at least 10 million in revenues? Because one of the things that we're looking for in business is that the company itself should have really an established product market fit, right? That is not a risk we're willing to take. Company having a right product market fit, it's easy to establish that by looking at gross and net retention stats, like sort of what their LTV to CAC, sort of has been. The other thing that we really focus on is the company growing and is the company addressing a large end market, right? So that's one of the things that it's pretty easy to establish just by looking at the numbers. What's sort of software and harder, softer and harder to sort of hone in on is the management team, right? Like, you want to have a CEO and CFO and the management team that's coachable, that you can work with side by side. We are partners to our companies, and so we really look for to partner with the entrepreneur, to partner with the operator.
Great. So for everyone's benefit, debt versus equity.
You're seeking to get paid back principal plus interest. You know, as part of that, you conduct due diligence. I heard references around the product, the market, the founding team. But when it comes to actually like diving into the financials, what are some of the red flags that you're looking for? Or, you know, you made reference to customer lifetime value. What are some of the other metrics that are top of mind that you're going to look to make a decision?
That's a great question, Christian. I think, you know, I stay away from things like red flags and things like that. I think the broader things that I look for while we're looking for company, and specifically as we delve into the financials and the metrics, are things like, number one, is the company audited, right? Like if a company has raised one or two rounds of equity, right? They should have an audit firm that they're either working with actively or about to get audited or have been audited, right? Like if a company has raised 3 to 4 rounds of capital, and I've seen this time and time again, where, you know, it's a Series C or D company and there's no audit in place, like there's a story there as to why there's no audit, right? It's as simple as, you know, finding out what the reasons are, right? Because many times a company may just have a Q of E, many times it might be international, and or many times it might be cost prohibitive, but there is a reason. Typically, if companies raise multiple rounds of financing and they haven't gotten an audit done, there's a reason for it. That's number one. Number two, metrics like LTV to CAC have become more and more important, because I think from a standpoint of efficiency and product market fit, number two things that are very important from a lender's perspective, right? Like we want to make sure that there's product market fit has been established, so our capital is being used to allay execution risk, right? So companies that have these LTV to CAC ratios that are either declining or stagnating, right? And then they haven't quite gotten to that 3x, that magic number of 3x that people look for. Finding the reason for that is important, right? Because it could just simply be the fact that they're coming from a large fundraise and they've just ramped up their sales and marketing. There's probably fundamentally nothing is wrong, but their CAC number is just larger, so their ratios are off. But really getting to the bottom of that, right? Because understanding that there is a product market fit versus there isn't a product market fit yet, that's kind of the more important thing to look for us. The other thing that we focus on is like sort of the gross and net retention numbers, right? Like if a company is an enterprise focused business, right? Typically speaking, we're seeing, you know, gross and net retention numbers are sort of in the 90% range to the 100 to 120% range for those, if it's an enterprise focused business, right? If it's a SME focused end market business, right, that you're talking to, then it's okay to have a gross retention maybe in the 70 to 80% range and the net retention to be in the 90% range. There, I think the most important thing is the company growing? Because if the company is not growing and has these gross net retention stats don't line with best practices or what should be, then that's a flag for us, right? And the soft thing that I focus on is a team, right? Because that's one of those things where it's taken me a long time to realize that this is almost more important than the actual financials at times. Because if the financial team or the finance person or the CEO is not somebody you can actually work with, right? That's a harder thing to fix. Secondly, like if the company's run a couple of rounds of funding and it's at that $5 to $7.5 million range and doesn't have a finance team, right? Or has a fractional CFO or a fractional finance team, there is a reason to actually hone in on that. Like it's one thing to have, it's one thing to be bootstrapped to a certain point, but then after a certain sophistication, you almost need that. And then the thing that focus on, since you asked about flags, is valuation. Is the company structurally fundable for future funding, whether it's equity and debt? Right, a lot of times we specifically saw this in 21 and 22, where the valuations for some of these companies were raising money at multiples that were so high, right, that they, you know, a couple of years down the road when they come back to raise money, if they haven't grown into those operating metrics to justify a lower compressed multiple, they have structural fundable issues, right? So we're seeing this now actively, right? Companies that were raising money in the 18 to 24 month cadence that raise money in 21, 22, right, at higher multiples are coming up for raising capital now in the equity markets, and they're seeing their multiples compress quite a bit. So debt has become a solution for them. They're also, you know, valuations have taken a bit of a, you know, they've come in. And so main thing is that, is a company structurally fundable from a future point of view, right? Like many times the company's raised at such a high valuation that no matter what the outcome might be, they'll have to get some kind of a valuation reset. And you don't want to be in a situation where that valuation becomes prohibitive for somebody else to come in.
That makes good sense. I mean, you know, it's really easy to just take away. I mean, you know, if what I'm hearing is you have to manage your risk. Prime among that is to ensure this business remains a going concern. It's a multivariate formula. And, you know, you have, it sounds like a very thorough checklist that's hitting on multiple parts of the business before you make a decision. So let's say, so post-investment, you know, obviously, you know, receiving payments upon the agreed upon schedule is one thing, but what other steps do you or Multiplier take to further manage your risk once the relationship's in place?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question. We have quarterly, I mean, I think the short answer is that we have quarterly reviews with all of our portfolio companies. And that's pre-wired in, by the way, in the docs that the company signs. So there's no surprise. You know, the company has to provide us with regular sort of financials, like in terms of certain financial metrics on a regular cadence. And then we have quarterly check-ins with the CFO. Sometimes there's CEOs involved as well. These both serve as a great way to make sure that the business is on covenant, on plan, right? And if there's potential issues coming down the pike, that we talk about it, right? As opposed to, nobody wants to be surprised, especially a lender does not want to be surprised. So these quarterly check-ins really help in getting that kind of cadence going.
Fantastic. Apologies, I didn't necessarily hear you mention it, but collateral, knowing sometimes it can be part of a covenant. What's your take and the role of having the company put up assets before you make a decision?
Yeah, I mean, look, most of the times, in fact, all the times, the companies that we're investing in are not yet cash flow profitable, right? So they're still burning cash for their growth. Typically, from when our capital comes in, we will only fund businesses with a fully funded business plan with our capital, right? So, and that could mean that there's near term, there's a cash burn, but it's coming down over time, right? Most of the companies we come in, you know, they don't really have hard collateral, right? These are enterprise value type of loans. The sort of collateral really is the IP, the cash in the balance sheet, the recurring revenue contracts that may or may not, you know, that are really mission critical. So they may have some weight to it, right? So we like to take, as a firm, we like to take an all asset lien on our companies, right? That includes the IP. And that's kind of the basis of our loads. But largely speaking, we try to hone in on LTV or the loan to values in that, you know, sub 20 to 25% range. Most of the loans that we'll do will be in the 10 to 15% range. I mean, that's kind of like how it's played out over the last probably several quarters.
Okay. If we could take a step back, earlier you mentioned what I heard was a multi or a career that spans multiple decades. Would love to hear what your experience was leading up to Multiplier Capital.
great question. The reason I chuckle is because, you know, I grew up in the Bay Area, right? And my background, having left the Bay Area to go to college, I always was very curious about technology, wanted to get a degree in computer science. So I went to college sort of in the late 90s. If you remember the late 90s, Christian, the internet was blowing up, right? .com companies were being formed. And I was very fortunate to go to school back east, you know, where we had a very solid computer science department, and I worked with a number of my students' peers to come up with ideas on how to start a startup while I was in college. You know, so in 99, when I graduated, it was kind of like, you know, I had multiple options to go either do coding or go work on Wall Street. You know, it was a great time to be looking for a job, right? It wasn't that I was anything special. It was just the fact that it was a really great time. I decided to choose the path less traveled, which is that I decided to start my own company that was an ed tech business, that was a SaaS ed tech business, right? The thing was, in 99, ed tech as a term hadn't been invented yet or wasn't really used. It was e-learning, and SaaS as a term had not been really, you know, in the vernacular. It was really an ASP, application services provider model, right? AWS didn't exist. So, like, you know, all of our tech was in these two Dell boxes that were each 20 grand on the floor of, you know, the cube I occupied. So it was an e-learning or ed tech SaaS business that, you know, I started. Unfortunately, timing was not as great, because by the time I came out looking for with a referenceable customer and a product that worked, it was 2001, so nobody would really touch me. Instead of giving up, I kind of bootstrapped my way for the next 5-6 years, and we were successful. We had an exit, and then ended up taking a couple of years off, got my MBA. And so decided that I wanted to stay in tech, but did not want to, I want to go into venture, but realized path to venture could be through potentially going through Wall Street. So I ended up actually joining JP Morgan in the corporate finance group, and as an investment banker. And I was there, timing was not great, as I started in 07, right before the GFC. So walk right into that. But, you know, all that to say, in 2010, I had the fortune of joining the venture community, venture asset class, and specifically venture debt. I didn't know what to expect. I got a job at Triple Point Capital, which is a pretty well-known venture debt firm. And that's sort of brought my full arc into venture debt. So the past 16 years, I've had the pleasure of being at various firms. I had the pleasure of running my own firm for a few years, Multiplier. My previous firm, Multiplier, we partnered on a number of deals together. So that's kind of the arc on how I ended up working with Multiplier.
Great. So as you reflect back on the career, you know, what are the reoccurring themes that you've seen among founders and operators that have stood the test of time?
It's a great question. I think the main thing, if I had to hone in on, are management teams and founders specifically that are absolutely frugal and are absolutely fluid in terms of their strategy, right? So they know where they want to go. They know exactly where they want to end up, but the path to getting to that, they have the ability to like zig and zag through to be able to get there. And many companies I've seen over the last, you know, my time, folks who are bent out of shape on a specific strategy, but they don't pivot fast enough to actually go, you know, to move the strategy around to get to the end point that they're looking for. And I feel like that's the one thing that I've seen as a common, it's more grit, and it's also sort of the ability to be fluid on and moving forward and pivoting as quickly as possible.
Grit's a great word. And I've also heard you mention teams. I'm curious whether or not, if you have an opinion of that, translate into founder singular or co-founders.
Oh, I think both. It doesn't matter, founder or co-founder. I think that if it's a co-founder situation, it's very clear. Like, you meet the co-founders together, the chemistry between the two has to jive. Like, there have been many times that I've been on calls with potential customers or with potential portfolio companies where you can tell that the co-founders are jiving together because they both know exactly what their lanes are. Other times you've got co-founders who are talking over each other, right? And so you know that those are the kinds of teams that are going to have the problems if you get into the situation where you become a lender, right? You want to be in a situation where the co-founders know exactly what their lanes are and what they're, you know, clearly one's focused on strategy, one's focused on product, or vice versa, right? As opposed to both the founders thinking that everything is a co-jointed decision. That's always a recipe for a disaster. So I think hopefully that kind of gets you to the answer you're looking for.
No, that's great. And so let's build on that. So, you know, I'd love to get your perspective. You know, have you seen a theme of common pitfalls that's befalled companies operating in the early stage? And then love to know what your opinions are to avoid them.
Yeah, I think a few things come to my mind. Okay. And I'll just kind of put them down in no particular order. Number one thing I mentioned to you was the team, right? Having the right people in the seats at the right time is important, right? Like we talked about the finance person being an important role to have. Like when you get to a $5 to $7.5 million run rate, you should have a finance seat that's filled, or have a very reputable firm that's managing your finances, right? You should be on a path to getting audited. Same thing with like a revenue officer or a sales officer, right? You want to make sure you have the right person that, you know, clearly if you're focused on SME and you have a person that's got an enterprise software background, not the best fit. So like having the right team in place and making pivots, by the way, if those team members don't work, to like actually quickly, you know, I'm not saying to churn them out, but like really move people around if they need to be. Mm-hmm. Number two, I think a lot of times founders and operators really lose track of the fact that they have to make sure and they show product market fit, right? So it becomes quite obvious in the metrics when you look at the metrics, whether the gross and net retention stats or the LTV CAC ratios and the spend versus the revenue accretion is going in the right direction. I think founders and CEOs have to have the right sort of bird's eye view at any given point in time. They have to be marching towards what will work, so that shows a story, right? I recently have had at least one company come through the top of funnel where the CEO was very charismatic, but there was, you know, one of the products just simply did not have a product market fit, and it was obvious in the numbers, right? But they knew the CEO's pivoted, trying to get it going, but like by the time that happened, right, the numbers had already shown a story, so now they have to wait a lot longer time to actually show the product market fit. In current times, I think, and beyond, I think the common, I've seen this now in the last 3 months alone, where a marquee funded, like inside Kleiner back businesses that have the attitude like, okay, we'll get funded, right? You know, so we'll have 3 to 6 months of cash on hand. I think the best practice in current times and beyond should be like having at least 12 months of cash on the runway at all times. Whether you're talking to an equity investor or a debt investor, I think that's the right signal to have. I think best practice could be even 18 months of cash on the balance sheet, but I think that's a lot for business to have, but at least 12 months. And then the last thing that kind of comes to my mind is, companies that have taken on debt, like they should be proactively working with their lenders, like in a partner environment, like not to treat the lender like they're some kind of a service provider, but to actually treat them as a partner. I think companies in situations where I've been, where they've been great outcomes for the lender and the borrower, are ones where the CFO literally will call me up and 2 quarters in advance will say, look, this may happen, you know, I'm just letting you know, right? So everybody's aware that if there is a issue on the operating side of things, if deals are getting pushed into future quarters, and if potentially there might be a covenant breach or not, like there is a information flow. I think a lot of management teams should know that working proactively, working with the lender is so important.
I think it's a great point. That has been, you know, a topic that's come up on the podcast before. And it's just, you know, founders and the C-suite should have an appreciation that, you know, everything doesn't go up in a straight line. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you understand that's the case, you know, it's totally not only acceptable, but expected, you know, to share the bad with the good. So I think it's a great point that you make. So, you know, I heard fluid, I heard pivot. Obviously now we have artificial intelligence that's having a really big impact on a number of companies' business. You know, would love to get your perspective of how you're thinking about the technology as you're looking to, you know, either the existing portfolio or to make new investments.
So it's outstanding question. I was asked to speak at my older son's high school class last week, and I made the analogy that I also had the privilege of going to the same school as my kid many 30 years ago, and so I made the point that to the students that were sitting there listening to me talk, I'm like, you guys are in a very interesting point in your lives, very similar to what I was 30 years ago, because 30 years ago was the internet. Now today it's AI and everything in AI, right? So to answer your question, are we focused on looking at AI as a technology to invest in? Absolutely, right? But let's take a step back. A couple of things are happening. Companies that have the word AI attached to them, their valuations are, I don't want to use superlatives, but the valuations are quite high, right? From a multiple perspective, from what they're delivering. I think at the end of the day, that's one of those things where time will kind of press on, and if operating metrics don't work out, then that'll be an issue. You know, that things will have, things will eventually come in. I think from currently, while this is all unfolding, it's very exciting. Like, I just read a post by Tomasz Tungis, who runs Theory Ventures. He wrote a post just a couple of days ago about how AI and social are working together. So now you can like write an X comment to at Grok, and Grok will respond back, right? Great time. But like, these technologies are still unproven. I feel like we're like in the first inning of like a multi-inning game, right? So do we want to be part of that? Absolutely. I think the key question is, when do these companies start becoming mature enough where they have the run rate, they have the established product market fit, they have the business models that are recurring and reoccurring for us to get involved in? So I think it's playing out. To be honest, Christian, is still playing out. And I think we're seeing companies all the time, coming through, but we're evaluating them as such. Many of them are pretty early still.
Yeah, I mean, it totally makes sense. I mean, my sense as well, I mean, if we just reflect, you know, in the last 3 years or 2.5 years, I mean, just how quickly it's evolved is beyond impressive. And you're right. I mean, if you were to, and I don't think it's debatable, we're in the first or second inning. We imagine what it's going to be like in a year from now, 5 years from now. Ash, it's been a great podcast. One of the questions that I enjoy wrapping up with is kind of a reflection. And so if you had an opportunity, go back and have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
I would tell my younger self to be more patient, be more fluid, and always make sure to give people direct feedback. I think that last part has come in as I've come into my own sort of more maturity. But in my earlier days, I was always worried about, you know, not providing direct feedback to people because I was afraid of how that might make them feel. Not to mention that I wasn't trying to be mean to them, but it was like, you know, people need to know what the feedback loop is. And I think that's one thing I would convey to myself. And I would tell myself, hey, it's going to be okay.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I've found I've had this conversation with my wife and my kids, and you know, there is absolutely this appreciation that, you know, the other party benefits from getting your perspective. My sense is many times, you know, you just never hear anything because people keep it to themselves. So I think that's great advice.
I think one of the biggest issues I've ever always had is I just lack patience. Like, you know, and then one of those things is patience comes with time. So that if I could convey that to my younger self, it would be probably it would save myself at least a decade.
You know, funny how it works.
Yes.
Ash, it's been a great podcast. If any of our listeners would like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
I'm on LinkedIn. All my contact information is there. And I get many messages on there, and I try to respond back to every single one. So I look forward to it. Thank you so much, Christian, for having me and for asking me to be on this podcast with you.
Yep, my pleasure. I'm glad you accepted the invite. This has been awesome. And with that, again, for our audience, Ash Vaidya, Managing Director of Multiplier Capital. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, Founder and CEO of FinTrap Management. Thank you for joining us another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Take care.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag innovators and investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.